Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 51. What if your roommate had a deep, dark secret?
Born and raised in Oakland. I was living in Denver and got into college here and needed to move back pretty suddenly. And it was this big change in my life. I was feeling really excited, was feeling really focused, had gotten great scholarship, and the path wasn't always leading to that point. So instead of getting a place with friends and sort of getting into old habits, I got a Craigslist house in West Oakland. And it was a beautiful Victorian house. And a young couple had just bought it and were fixing it up. There was about four of us living there. Most of us were involved in some sort of, I guess, social services, we can call it. One of them was working with a foundation here with adolescents that had dealt with sexual abuse. One of them worked at a women's clinic. I was volunteering with a barrier rape organization, and then there was the other roommate. Incredibly soft-spoken, I remember we would refer to him as Tiny Tim, is his voice. And he had an incredibly sort of asexual but very interesting characteristic to him. I remember he wouldn't let his cat see him naked. But we ended up building somewhat of a relationship, and he had grown up in the same area. And he would always refer to things like, I won't be able to vote in this upcoming election, and I don't really see my family much. His father would come over, and he always looked at us kind of like we were doing this huge favor to let the roommate live with us. And there were sirens going off in me, but they weren't the normal female, kind of creepy male roommate sirens, you know, that intuition. But there was always something wrong, and I just wanted to say, hey, you know, don't be so judgmental. Like, you know, here you are in transition, and, you know, you carry your scars and your stories, and maybe this person does too, and they're just kind of different. And he eventually started to really want to know a lot about my history. You know, why was I working with this barrier rape organization? What had happened to me when I was a child? What had happened to me when I was a teenager? You know, why did I have scars on my arm? You know, why did I have that tattoo? I always kept everything clean. He liked to go down to Chinatown, and his cat was named Bird. I remember that. Anyway, my best friend and I, after a ruckus night on the town, a lot of drinking, I don't know if I can say this, a little cocaine happening, and we had this horrible bet, a really cynical bet, I mean, oh God, about who had more sex offenders living in their neighborhood. Him in North Oakland and me in West Oakland. And you can go on Megan's Law, which is an amazing website. People that aren't familiar with Megan's Law, it is the California Registry of Sex Offenders. So we go to his neighborhood first, and, you know, we're kind of not really counting, but, you know, looking it up and just going, ah, yikes, you know, geez, this world is crazy, you know, and this is our home, and that guy, I saw that guy at the corner store yesterday, and he's, you know, a rapist. So then we go to my neighborhood, and we're looking through, and he's like, what is that star on your house? I'm like, well, that's just showing in proximity to where my house is, in proximity to all the sex offenders. He's like, no, I didn't have a star on my house. And it was blinking, it was very big. I shouldn't be laughing. So I click on it, and Tiny Tim, as we called him, roommate, shows up. And my heart dropped. He is literally wearing the turtleneck that, like, I can imagine him right now. He wore it every day. And he kind of looked like Weird Al Yankovic. And I went, oh, fuck. So at first I'm thinking he's a rapist and I'm in danger, but I'm thinking, why didn't your sirens go off? So we click on it and we look it up, and then we start doing a lot of research on him. And he was a pedophile. He had raped his sister for years. There was forced oral copulation, forced anal on a child under 10. Really horrible. I don't know if you can quantify the pain of sexual abuse, but you know, when it's a family member and a child, it just made me so angry, so violated. I felt like anything that had happened to me in the past just coming to a surface in anger. It's probably like 2 a.m. at this point, and you know, I'm like really freaking out, and my best friend's going, it's okay, you know, you can stay with me, whatever we need to do. Like, so I immediately tell the roommates, and I felt like they were pushovers, and they said he could stay a month. And I said, I won't step foot in that house. I don't care if I have a lease with you. And they understood, you know, they were cool about it. I mean, I lost my home, you know, my first semester of college. They had basically therapeutic meeting. You know, one was getting a master's in social work. So they basically had a confrontation with him in a safe environment in the house. And they asked me if I wanted to say anything, if I wanted to be there. And I didn't. I was angry that they would allow him to stay. I mean, there is a way, something about the sister and the child, you know, it was like every siren in me was just screaming. And I knew, like, I mean, I am from Oakland, like, I probably would have, like, strangled the bastard, you know. And the worst part of it all was there was an elementary school just a block away from us, and his trigger was 5 to 7-year-old girls. What happened in this situation was his sister reported to a therapist before she was like 16. So it was years later, and he was 18. I don't know. Basically, he copped a plea, and he had been checking in. He had been in treatment, which there really is no treatment for pedophilia. It's, you know, castration. So it made me so scared. You know, it made me scared for the children. Made me scared. Did I ever leave my god sisters alone? You know, what is this? You know, what's going on? No wonder he always would reference, I just don't have a good relationship with my sister. Now I know why you can't vote. It all became clear, and all the wanting to know about the histories and the record books of us women in there and why we were in this. It was all his way of saying, I'm okay. I'm better. And then he shared with them what was going on. So his trigger, 5 to 7-year-old girls. I guess it had happened with someone else, but he wasn't caught. I don't know much about that. They should have reported that. You know, that he was in a treatment and going to meetings for pedophiles. PA, I don't know, Pedophile Anonymous, I'm not sure. But, you know, and working the program. But I felt like, obviously, he wasn't if he was living next to an elementary school. So I never stepped a foot in that house again until it was the last day of the month. And I wanted to get my stuff, and he had some of my stuff. He had borrowed a desktop keyboard from me. His father was there moving him out, and he had somehow found a place. He comes to my door, and he says, and he knows, you know, that I'm the one that did this, and they had had a house meeting where, like, I let them know I did not want to be at the meeting. And his father kind of pulls me aside and is like, you know, apologizes. I don't know what the story was with them. I mean, this is your son who had raped your baby daughter. I mean, the dynamics of that were messy, messy, messy. The pedophile roommate came up to me and said, you know, I have this keyboard for you. Is there anything you can do for me? And this was the first time I think I really, really felt anger, deep anger. And I turned to him and I looked him in the eye and I said, there is something you can do for me. And he's like, oh, what? And I said, you can get on Muni, you can get on a ferry, you can take a cab, you can hitchhike, you can do whatever you want, you get on the Golden Gate Bridge and you jump off it. I'd never, ever said anything like that to anyone. I never, and I felt it. I don't feel it anymore, but I felt it. I felt like he was the catalyst, or his face was everything that I was angry about. You know, and I sat in front of his father too, and his father didn't come to his defense. And he looked hollow. He looked a little shocked, but not as shocked as like if someone said that you knew, or you know, someone that's high functioning and not a pedophile, you know. I mean, like, but who knows his level of self-loathing? Who knows if he feels bad about it? I think he was just kind of waiting for it to happen. I don't know if he ever jumped off the bridge, but we did end up seeing him about 6 months later at a warehouse party in downtown. And, you know, we let the roommates know. He got kicked out of there too. And, you know, looking back now, it's kind of a gray area, you know. What do you do with people like that? You know, do you put them on the street? Do you, you know, round them up and kill them? You know, no, you can't. You know, these are people too. Are they good people? I don't know. What do you do with people like that? I just have no idea. You know, it would be a hard profession to be in. But I really, really thought it would be best if he had killed himself at that moment. And I never heard from him again. You know, it impacted my recovery, you know, my victimization. It impacted what I wanted to do with my life. It impacted me coming to terms with my anger. And that and a couple other situations really impacted me wanting to leave Oakland. Now I'm back. But I needed to leave because I wasn't in the place to be strong enough to take on that kind of interaction. I was raped when I was 12 by my parents' friend at this like kind of artsy hippie conference they would make me, my brother and I go to every year. You know, I had to go from time I was like 8 until then. I refused to go back, of course. And I hated it. There was no structure for kids. I remember one year I was trying to find my mom, and she had divorced my dad when I was 5, but he actually would go too. That was when they got along, and I remember I was looking for them. I had to like skin my knee, and I walked into the banquet hall, and there was like 50 adults having a crying ritual. Like, talk about traumatic for a 9-year-old. You know, like, it's because they're just all crying. There's a shaman. I mean, just this Berkeley New Age bullshit. I was turning 13, like, the next month. You know, I'd matured very early, and it was a virgin, you know. Ugh, it was shitty. And I got really, really drunk the last night, and was with one of the other younger guys who has actually become a good friend of mine. I was like, I'm about to throw up. Like, I'm going to pass out. So I went, and I passed out in one of the non-used cabins. And I just remember it was this, there was no sheet on it. It was just like the linoleum feeling of those like shitty mattresses. And I passed out, and I woke up, and yeah, I knew immediately. I don't know. I mean, I know now who it was, but I wasn't really conscious for it at all. And it was sodomy, so that was, I knew immediately because there was blood everywhere. Even though I'd never had sex, didn't, you know, I immediately knew something was different about me. Immediately. And I threw up everywhere, you know. And I remember my dad finding me. Of course, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to tell him. I'm drunk. He's pissed. I remember he had to carry me because I couldn't walk. And he thought it was because I couldn't walk because I was drunk. But I really just couldn't walk. And I laid in bed for the next day. And then we flew home. What messed me up the most, and this is, you know, interesting or weird, or I don't know, there's no right or wrong way to recover from this kind of thing, and it took me years, was all you're talking about is who's losing their virginity, you know, who's making out with who, who's getting to what base, and all I could think about was I just wanted something else inside of me. Like, literally, that's what all I could think of. Like, I thought that would purge me, and of course then I just sought out the worst guys possible. I mean, just, you know, it just makes me so scared to have a daughter, you know. Like, I just sought out these horrible guys. And I just kept getting raped over and over again, basically. I mean, it wasn't the same. And then I got really into drugs. Dropped out of high school in my first semester of ninth grade. I had lots of friends, you know, I was beautiful, but I just hated the world. I tried to kill myself, and then they sent me away. So I was sent away for 16 months. When I was in the first treatment center, they sent me to like a boot camp, a wilderness boot camp for 30 days in the high desert of Nevada, where you had to hike like 18 miles a day with a pack, and you're not allowed to talk to anyone unless you're spoken to, and you can't doodle, and you have to fill out all these forms. And so I let it slip, you know, like, I was raped, counselor, and they had to report it, you know, because I was underage. And so I wasn't really cooperative because I just wanted to get out of the treatment center. I just wanted to get back home, you know. And you know, you kind of get taught as an adolescent in treatment that if you, the more you reveal and the more you fall and then you show them how good you pick yourself up, then they'll get you. That's how you get out. And so you really learn to manipulate your feelings, you know. And so you learn to reveal and then fall and then race to the finish line, you know what I mean? And I, the worst part of that was I had to tell my mother. And I remember we had to do disclosures after the wilderness. So it was me and like six other kids and their parents. And I had to tell my mom, you know, they made me tell her in front of everyone. You know, hey mom, like your friends raped me. And she said, I'm sorry you believe that happened, but I will not change my friends or the way I live my life because of that. And I don't know if that's because my mom is the queen of cognitive dissonance. She's, I mean, we have an amazing relationship now, but she didn't want to touch that. There's a researcher named Thomas DeShawn, and he coined this term called contagious deviancy in adolescence. And it's basically about how ineffective group therapy is for adolescents, at-risk adolescents. And so that's all we really did, was group therapy with our team. And then we'd have individualized. So for, you know, sexual abuse victims, which was pretty much everyone there, you know, there's adopted kids, there's drug issues. So I was in those two, you know, they put you in specialized groups. And, you know, that term contagious deviancy, it's like, you know, when you're an adolescent, you have to, you gravitate towards a leader. And in a healthy situation, it's someone that's positive. And in a treatment center where you're all suffering, you gravitate towards the most deviant. And I was one of those. So people gravitated towards me, you know, and they loved my cuts and they loved, you know, and the one thing, it was just never enough, you know? It was never enough what happened to you. I mean, it was just like, I remember the girls, we'd play this game called Remember When. And we would just be like, remember when that happened? Remember when that happened? Remember when that guy raped us? Remember when that? Remember when we saw that? Remember when we saw that? Remember when we saw, you know, our mom get our ass beat? You know, it was just this, like, all it was war story. And it just taught me how to just become completely metaphorically unzipped with all my feelings out, no boundaries. I mean, I still don't have great boundaries, but and no tools to zip myself back up. So when I got out, all I could think about was getting out of high school, and I caught up with high school there. So I finished and ended up graduating high school, like actual graduation, no GED, when I was 16. So I was 14 when I got sent away. So that was great. So then I started going to community college and moved out when I was 17. I got engaged to a guy I met there. Bad call. Don't date people in treatment. And kind of struggled with drugs and struggled with, you know, my own, where I belonged. And I did not know, I did not at all deal with the rape at all. I went to therapy and, you know, I continued kind of just self-harm, you know. Everyone has a story, like so many women. It's just, you know, one in four women, you know, it's more than that at least. I feel like I'm not like a martyr. It doesn't make me unique. You know, being a victim is kind of, can be a little narcissistic at times if you don't let it go. I just don't feel sad anymore or angry. It shifted when I got sober. Yeah. You know, I got on the Suboxone treatment and then was sober for about 2 months, and I was with a partner that didn't give me ultimatums. You know, they didn't say you need to be sober. He just said, I know when you're sober, I know you want. I was about 17 years younger than him. And some might say that's weird, but it worked. And I said to him, you know, this is when I was still high, I said, why don't you just treat me like a catch? Because I'm thinking I'm young, you know. And he turns to me and goes, I'll start treating you like a catch when you start acting like one. And that was like, I felt like I'd got slapped, but it was that catalyst moment for me where I went, oh, this person is evaluating me, not because I'm younger and I'm a trophy or whatever. That was that point. And then I wanted him to see me like that. And I knew he could. And he was the first person I ever knew that could tell when I was on drugs, because I was pretty, you know, kind of high functioning. And got clean. And I didn't think that anyone could help me. I thought, you know, I knew it's about me, but I didn't think anyone's partnership, especially from a guy, could help me. And, you know, letting them in was very healing for me. And then also, you know, decide to move. So moving to Texas was a big step. And then you can just, when you move somewhere and you don't know anyone, I've never even been to Texas my whole life, you know, and it was just me and him, I could be whoever I wanted to be. Something switched. And then everything switches, like my relationship with my family. You know, I thought I'd never talk to my mother again. And look at us now, you know, it's like, I just stayed with her for a month, you know? And it was great. She's hilarious. So now I've moved back, and I mean, this is home, you know? This is my home. This is where I'm from, and everyone I know is in my friend family is here, that it's in California. The past 2 months have been so amazing. I mean, I just feel like a Hallmark card, kind of, you know. I feel so present right now. It's been this insane, like, emotion even just surging forth in me of like, I just want to, like, cry for joy, you know. It hasn't always been easy. The drugs have been a thing, but, you know, I've been 3 years sober, and now being able to work with people that are going through this is pretty powerful. So it's all kind of coming full circle, you know, being back here, and I just feel like it's happening, you know, and it's just happening finally for me.